Thanks, Matt. Good evening, everyone. Nice to see you all. Tonight I thought we would take a slightly different tack than usual. So I apologize for all of you who are 12 and over tonight. I'm trying to gear this class a little bit to those who are a little bit younger. Because I want to get some answers. So I might have to come right down off the platform so I can just hear those answers sometimes. But one of the things that I, when you see this picture, now this doesn't have to be 12 and under, this can be any age. When you see this picture, what do you see?
Clouds.
Some people see clouds, okay. What did somebody say? America? North America? Okay. Good, okay.
Yeah?
The Earth. Okay, excellent. What I want us to also think about tonight is that, do we not see God?
No.
No. Okay. So, let's think about that. That's a good answer because I'm pretty sure some of us here on my next slide says, has anybody here seen God?
No.
No. That's kind of sad. Isn't that sad when you think about it? That we all say, no, we haven't. Is it possible for us to see God?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so now we're getting yeses. So we have a yeses, but nobody's seen God. So what are we getting at here? Well, let me just back up a bit. When we see, imagine, this amazing piece of planet that we live on, and we notice the different colors of green for forests, for fields, and we notice the lakes, if you can see them, Great Lakes anyways. We notice the oceans. And we notice that God has done all of that exactly as He wanted to. He set it out for us, for our pleasure, and we want to be able to see, and someone said clouds. Don't forget about the clouds that bring rain. So, I would suggest that we can see God. Maybe not visually, but we can see Him in His character. What does the verse mean in Psalm 34 then when it says, taste and see that the Lord is good? What does that mean? How can you taste something and see that the Lord is good? What do you think? So this is obviously older than 12 question probably, but does that mean that we actually can
experience?
We can experience things such as a walk in nature, such as looking more deeply at how can I decide that if I have an itch in my head, I can just decide with my finger to scratch it. If we think about how we have been created, surely we can see a creator behind it. And so again, I imagine that as we many of us, if we may be in a dark room, but we hear someone's voice that's familiar, we can see that person in our mind, an attribute, because we know who they are. We know their demeanor, their personality, depending on how well we know them. And so, what I want us to think about a little bit is that, when we look at God's creation, that we should see God in it. I want us to be able to kind of help us to reinforce that for us tonight. Because, we have passages like this that say, the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows His handiwork. Now, the firmament. Now there's a big question. What is the firmament? I just want to say it again. Firmament, because I never say that word. Any of the young people know what a firmament is? So it's kind of like you see all this stuff around the outside. It's like the vast expanse. When you look up, how many of you have looked up into the heavens, up into the sky at night? And you've seen all that's what we call the firmament. It looks like it's stretched out all across. And that's what we would call the firmament. And when we look at that, can we imagine that God has set all of those pieces in place? And so here, the psalmist
found this on the web.
Which I should probably get this out of my... Do I even have my... Oh, that's my watch telling me that. I was like, what's telling me that? So the psalmist tells us that it declares the glory of God. And what's the glory of God? Some of his characteristics, who he is. And so those things help us to understand and visualize the God that we all love and worship. So that's what we want to do a little bit tonight. There's another passage in Romans that says, his eternal power and his divine nature have been clearly perceived, or other versions say clearly seen, ever since the creation of the world. How? Well, in the things that he has been made. And so some writers will say they see God through his creation. So that's what I want us to sort of think about in our lives. When we see things that are so amazing and so wondrous that we see God in them. And then we have this this passage in Job. And I'll read this. I have a longer version here, but I just put this shorter one up in quotes. It says, "But just ask the animals and have them teach you, and the birds of the sky, and have them tell you. Or speak to the earth and have it teach you, and have the fish of the sea tell you. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In whose hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind?" And so why would Job say, oh, go talk to the animals? What's he saying there? Does he mean actually like have a conversation with the animals? We can actually talk to them and they'll give us an answer? No, he means that when we go and inspect the animals and we look at all of their unique features, that they don't question how did they get how they were, but they would understand, if they could understand to the same extent, that this is all that's done by a creator. And so that's what Job was getting at, that all of these things understand that there's a creator who gave us all these things. And so what I want to do tonight, if I haven't said so already, is I want to spend some of our time considering some of God's creation so that we can see him more clearly and through some of the creatures he's created. And so I thought I'd start out with a little bit of a thought about some of those migrating animals. Now, this is where we can get back into the 12 and unders here. Apart the 12 and unders, except, you know, for those who traveling from Courtney and that kind of thing, you know, I didn't cover all bases here tonight. Apologize, but anybody who feels comfortable, you know, feel free to answer my questions. So that it'll go faster that way. How many of you have hummingbird feeder at your house? Oh, good. I feel heartened. That's really good. Because some hummingbirds have decided that, you know, going down south is probably a little bit, you know, challenging, and they depend on us now to have these feeders for them. But aren't they just an amazing, amazing bird when you think about it? They can hover. They can fly backwards. I think they're the only bird that can fly backwards. Well, they can fly forwards too, but they can hover. Their wings flap at something like 80 beats per second. And I haven't tested this myself, but it says that their heartbeat is 1,200 beats per minute. I was going to say, how many is that per second then? But I don't want to go there. I can't think while I'm just speaking here. But then they mainly, we know that they mainly eat from your hummingbird feeders right now. They only eat from you. So make sure they're nice and clean. Make sure that you give 4 to 1, four parts water, one part sugar. You don't need to add any of that dye stuff. That's just extra stuff. Anyways, they depend on us during the winter, don't they, for living and sustaining them. But most of them will fly down. Oh, Dave?
We got a picture of a hummingbird sitting on our front porch with snow on its head.
On its head?
Yeah.
Oh, but it was still alive, so.
Oh, yeah.
So that's good. That's good. I had one that got stuck on my thing at one point last year, but anyways, it survived. We managed to bring it in and get it off. But the ones I want to talk about aren't those ones. They're the ones that actually decide to fly way south to find their own food, rather than be lazy and take the food that we're offering them. But again, there's a cycle that God's built into them where they normally need to eat every like 15 minutes. They eat twice their body weight in 24 hours. And their body weight is like, I was going to say a penny, but some of the, those of you probably don't even know what a penny is anymore. They're very light, and they have to fly thousands of miles to continue to find the pollen that they need. And yet, they're able to migrate. Now, I'm not going to spend any time on Canada geese, because they're not really one of my favorite animals, I'm going to say. But they are God's creation. God's created them wondrously. They have these really cool V formations that they fly in so that they can share energy as they follow the drag behind the ones that are in the lead, and they've got oil in their feathers to keep away from the rain and the cold. And so again, God's created all these creatures. But salmon, how many got the Gold Stream this year? Okay, I mean, what? Who are the parents who are not taking their children to Gold Stream every year? Like, we dragged our kids out to Gold Stream every single year to watch these. Oh, okay, we've got a couple coming up. Think about the salmon. How does a one fish lays all these eggs in one stream on Vancouver Island called Gold Stream? These fish swim all the way down to the ocean when they get bigger. And they get bigger, and they get bigger, and they get bigger. And some of them come back in 2 years. Some of them come back in 4 years. The really big ones come back in 4 years. And they come back. They go all the way thousands of miles up. They go up past Alaska. And then all of a sudden they decide, oh, it's time to turn around. They come all the way back, and they're managing to find the exact same stream or river that they were born in. And even some studies have suggested that they are within like 100 meters of the stretch of stream that they were born in. And so how do we not see God in that cycle? And I don't want to really nerd out on some of that stuff, but you imagine they happen to come up into the streams the exact time when bears are getting very hungry and need to fatten up so that they can hibernate for the winter. Just coincidence? Again, God's got all of these design pieces in mind when he's done his creation. And so, salmon and another one, but the one I want to talk a little bit about, is this one on the bottom right. Which one, what's that called?
Monarch butterfly.
Monarch butterfly. Good job. All right. So we're going to just kind of come back to this planet here, and some of you already recognize what's the, this is for the 12 and unders again, this is for your geography lessons. What continent are we talking about here? Continent?
The Gulf of America.
No, continent. Continent first.
North America.
If we're going to go back to 12 and under again, North America now, what country are we talking about? What, I said 12 and under, and I don't understand.
Mentally, physically?
So anyways, we're gonna keep diving down into this little part of Mexico. Thanks, Josiah, for that. And we're gonna talk about this amazing butterfly. Now, what's some of the facts that are really cool about monarch butterflies? Some of you 12 and under must know, so, hey, thank you. They can slow down their aging. Wow. Did you know that? How do they do that? God's created that. Anything else? Oh, you just took my excitement away. I was just going to go over that one fact, and you just completely got it right off the bat. Anything else? They look cool. Look. So this is the other thing that's amazing for me about not seeing, when you all disappointed me and said, I don't see God at all in this, but like, just looking at all of the features on this butterfly, and then you imagine that's just one of millions of different features that we have in all of his creation. But what I want to spend just a little bit of time on is this one, because this is the one that everyone talks about. But how many, there are quite a few actually, I realized, that go from egg to caterpillar, to chrysalis. Well, not chrysalis, but you know, others go through a cycle like this. But imagine. So, how long do you think that the egg takes to hatch? Anyone? Gonna guess? 3 weeks. That's pretty good. It's 3 to 5 days. So, so the egg hatches, and then we get into this caterpillar, and it goes from a little tiny little caterpillar, and within 2 weeks, sometimes a little bit longer, it goes onto this like, you know, fairly big caterpillar. Again, we imagine that this is a cycle that God's created. He didn't want it to just become an egg and a butterfly. He's wanted it to go from an egg to a caterpillar and then transform into a butterfly. And so chrysalis, how long do you think it's in a chrysalis for?
3 weeks.
2 weeks. Close, you're getting closer. So we're just kind of keeping track of all this of this time frame here, because I want to reference it back when we get to some of the other exciting facts about them. But so what I want to think about then is, how long do you think that butterfly lives?
3 weeks.
You're sticking with 3 weeks. Do you want to change your answer? Pardon?
Up to 6 weeks.
Okay. So let's just take a look at that. It is it's 2 to 4 weeks usually, but it could be a little bit longer. But I want to sort of put an asterisk beside that. Park it for now. We'll come back to that. So let's just think about all this that God's created. So imagine if we're trying to come up with all of these things. They start in that little place in Mexico. And they fly up towards Canada, because we see them in our, where we live. But I'm going to talk about the ones that are kind of on the eastern side anyways for now. So they go through the cycle and starts out in Mexico. They fly north, kind of north, northeast. And they get this far, we get about this far, and then they die. Okay, so that's about, like, if it's, like, let's imagine if it's 3 to 4 weeks of life getting up there. They then lay the egg, caterpillar, chrysalis, second generation, gets up to about there. So they're living about this amount of time, and then they go through the process again. What are they eating, by the way?
Milkweed,
good, that's good, yeah. So they eat milkweed, going up, and then here we get into the third generation. We're getting into this cycle, right? And then we get to this generation, up into here, and then, so these all live, like, oh, am I dying already? Oh, that's good. This lives like 3 to 4 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks. Guess how long this one lives? 8 months. Up to 8 months. It's like, so wait a minute, like, how does that happen? How does a cycle that goes, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks, and that one goes, hey, wait a minute, we've got some super ones we're going to lay, and we're going to lay them so they live like 8 months long. So they can fly all the way back down to Mexico and start the cycle again. And then, you talk about salmon, it's one thing with salmon, you go, well, you know, they probably have scent memory, and they get into the zone. This stream smells familiar. I'm going to go up to this stream. I've been here before when I was like really tiny. I'm going to go up here and I lay my eggs here. But these butterflies up here have been nowhere near Mexico before. It's like their great grandfather or mother have been the ones that were down there. And how do they even know that A, they're going to live 8 months, and then they're going to go all the way back down to repeat the cycle. Now, why would these ones need to live that long? Why don't they just go down, 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 down? Why don't they just do a repeat? Well, what do they eat? What's happening to milkweed? I mean, as if they were to lay the eggs, because these guys eat the pollen, but the milkweed's not in a condition where they can, as they start to go south, where they can have healthy young. So they have to get back down to Mexico to start the cycle again. And so isn't that amazing when we think about it? That when we see the butterfly, the monarch butterfly, to imagine how God solved some of those issues that are necessary for their survival. To me, it's just amazing when we think about all of that in one little critter, beautiful critter that God's given us. And so what do we learn about this? Well, I think we've covered it, but it migrates 4,000 kilometers from Canada, from the U.S. to a small patch in a forest in Mexico, and they've never been there before. How do they know where to go? It's even more of a conundrum than the salmon. And it takes four generations to complete one migration cycle, and yet those last ones know exactly where to go. I think my battery's going on this. I may have to use the old right button. Psalm 32 says, "I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go, and I will advise you with my eye upon you." And now, Uncle Mike, you're misquoting the Psalms. This is talking to a person about instructing you and teaching you in the way you should go. But yes, you're correct. But what I'm saying is that if God's given us His Word to instruct us and teach us in the way to go, He's also built into all of His creation instructions on how they should go and when what they need to do to continue to maintain the cycle. Okay, so how about the hummingbird? Again, this one is another amazing bird. We've talked a little bit about it, but I'll just give you some facts. They're the smallest of all migrating birds. I think some of these facts I probably covered as I was speaking earlier. They're the only birds that can fly backwards. They weigh less than a nickel. I think I had a penny. Well, a penny's less than a nickel, so. They can consume up to twice their body weight in a day. They need to feed every 15 minutes. Their wings beat over 1,000 times per minute. And they migrate alone up to 800 kilometers a day. So again, in their migration, they're able to consider their route and they're able to be provided for by God. Dave?
Does anybody know where Atlan is?
Atlan? Mm-hmm. Like in the interior?
You know where Skagway is? My sister lives in Atlan and they have hummingbirds up there.
Wow.
And they leave in August.
just for safety, yeah. Wow, interesting.
But that's a long way.
That's a very long way, yeah. Again, they too go to Mexico. I mean, Myra's in Mexico, so I mean, I guess it's a kind of a common thing that we do. We go down to Mexico where it's warm. But again, a couple of passages just on this idea of birds and migration. When we consider Job, does the hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? So again, God has built into these animals, these birds, the wonderful knowledge of when it's time to head south, when it needs to find warmth and safety and feed for itself. And God's built these into these animals. Even the stork in the heavens knows her appointed times. And the turtle dove, the swift, and the swallow observe the time of their coming. But my people do not know the judgment of the Lord. And so, again, that's the last passage was sort of like, yeah, all of my creation, these birds all understand the right time to do the right things. But yet, sometimes us, in all of our own knowledge and wisdom, don't know that time. Okay, so I want to do one more thing, and this is a video, and actually, it's good that Dave Higgs is here, because I remember Jeff Higgs actually introduced me to these wonders of creation. So if parents haven't found these series, they're amazing. They're little snippets for us to look at some little piece of creation that God's given us, and they give us amazing insights into some of these creatures. So it's about 4 minutes in length, and I'm not sure if this is going to be heard online. Apologies in advance. I may stand close to this just so that my mic might pick it up. And I don't know how loud it's going to be here, so I'll work on the volume. So this is a trial.
Its eyes are like something from a Batman movie. Its feeding tentacles shoot out of its mouth like birthday party blowers. Its blood is bluish green and its ink is black. Scientists believe that these amazing animals have a complicated system of communicating with each other, including the use of dozens of different body patterns. Making the cuttlefish even stranger is the fact that it's not even a fish, but a mollusk. Who named this animal anyway? A cuttlefish has an internal shell called a cuttle bone. The scientists classify it as a mollusk. Perhaps the most amazing feature of cuttlefish is their ability to blend into their surroundings. Cuttlefish have been said to have the world's best camouflage skills. Cuttlefish have the ability to change the texture of their skin to mimic the shape of certain barnacle-encrusted rocks or corals. What if we could do that? These mollusks can move their entire bodies into a variety of positions. For example, while swimming next to large seaweed, cuttlefish can mimic the grass's motion by positioning and waving their eight arms in a similar way that the seaweed sways in the water. This makes it very difficult for both attackers and possible prey to know exactly where the cuttlefish is. In a study a few years ago, scientists placed horizontal and vertical stripes on the walls of different cuttlefish tanks. How did the cuttlefish react? These creatures spread their bodies out horizontally when in the horizontally lined tanks, and they raised at least one arm vertically when in the vertically lined tanks. But what must annoy predators more than anything is the cuttlefish's ability to change color and to do so so quickly. A cuttlefish can change the color of its entire body in the blink of an eye. If this mollusk wants to change to red, it sends signals to its pigment sacs to change to red. A cuttlefish can hide from other sea life by changing to the color of the sand or seaweed. It can also appear as a strobe light, quickly blinking on and off, likely to confuse predators. So extraordinary are these masters of camouflage, as some have called them, that government researchers have even looked into the possibility of copying cuttlefish camouflage for use in the military. Researchers are enamored with how cuttlefish achieve their quick and convincing camouflage. Nevertheless, the researchers admit it's highly unlikely that anyone could achieve that same level of camouflage. Scientists find it difficult mimicking the color-matching abilities of the cuttlefish as well as its texture-matching ability. In fact, no one knows exactly how cuttlefish match their backgrounds so effectively, especially since experiments have shown that cuttlefish don't look at their skin to check how well it matches the background. What's more, if, as some scientists believe, this animal is colorblind, only seeing in shades of green, how does it always choose the color most helpful, like changing to the color of sand when on the ocean floor? Cuttlefish are remarkable creatures. Evolutionists have called the animal a genius. Researchers admit that cuttlefish are sophisticated, intelligent, tailor-made creatures with a secret code. Yet evolution is often the very first word many think of to explain the existence of the cuttlefish. But how can intelligence arise from non-intelligence? How can something tailor-made have no tailor? No one would suggest that Morse code is the product of time and chance. Yet some evolutionists would have us believe that the cuttlefish's secret code is the product of millions of years of mindless accidents. The fact is, naturalistic evolution cannot rationally explain the cuttlefish. The real code giver, the intelligent designer who tailor-made the cuttlefish, is God. As the psalmist proclaimed, "This great and wide sea in which are innumerable teeming things, living things, both small and great, O Lord, how manifold are your works. In wisdom, you have made them all."
All right, I just watched some of those, and I find them amazing to imagine how, you know, watching that little animal just decide to change and to incorporate itself into other pieces. And there's a whole bunch of them that are on the internet to watch. So I think I recommend that they're really good watching. For these kind of things. But, I mean, tonight we've really only looked at three creatures of God's creation, haven't we? Really looked at the butterfly, or the monarch in particular, the hummingbird and the cuttlefish. But imagine if we considered the beauty of His entire creation. There's an estimated to be something in the order of over 1.5 million different animals, species, so like insects, anthropods, fish, reptiles, birds, mammals, amphibians, and mollusks, as we just saw. So each one of those, each one of them has its own uniqueness about it, and it's just, it's incredible to me that a creator can make such a diversity of these creatures, and they're all designed for a purpose on this earth. And so imagine if God has a purpose for everything in his creation, then he absolutely has a purpose for you. And you're very special to God, and he wants you to recognize him in your life by the things that you do to show your love for him. And so we want to always try to look for God in everything that we do, as we try and seek him. And God's creation, I can suggest, is his invitation for us to seek him. Now, I have a little bit of a collage of animals here, but I want to distill this down into 12, because last Sunday, I talked to 12 of our youth, 12 and under. Just so happens to be 12, so lots of 12s going on here. And asked them what their favorite animal was. And so I thought, you know, once we match these favorite animals up, you know, we have some of them that are in your home. Hopefully not the entire top row are in your home, but at least two of the top, you know. To those that are outside, maybe in a cage, but, you know, oftentimes some of these are in the wild or in the water. But again, what I found interesting was, out of the 12 I surveyed, I got 12 different ones. And again, it speaks to us of God providing for all of our interests and all of the things that we're fascinated with. I've put together a little bit of a fun fact for each of these. And then what we're going to do is I'll reveal the person's favorite one, so that maybe that might be your favorite one. I mean, maybe that rat is the one that you've always wanted to connect somebody with. You've just been too shy to tell someone that that's one of your favorite animals. And so we're going to just have a look at that. But imagine cats. So let's go through some of these facts here. Cats can rotate their ears 180 degrees, and they can do it independently. So they have one of the best senses of hearing. They can find the direction even in the darkness. So and then we have the Komodo dragon. So the Komodo dragons have venom glands, so they often fight each other, but they also have a bacteria-resistant immune system that's so strong that infections rarely harm them after they have a brutal fight. So that's pretty cool. A bunny rabbit. This bunny, I don't know if it meets this particular fact, but it says a rabbit's eyes are positioned so they can see almost 360 degrees, so it can see all around in case any predators are coming for it, because a lot of predators go for it. And then we have the rhino. Guess how much a rhino weighs?
3,000 pounds.
Close, even more. 4,000 pounds. That's amazing. And they can run up to 55 kilometers an hour. That's faster than most of us, maybe Matt excluded, but can ride a bike. So that's pretty fast. So they can run for that much weight. And then we have rats. Now rats are kind of interesting. They're excellent problem solvers. You know, if you ever watch them get into a maze and they figure their way out of a maze, and then they can remember that as well, and they learn from that, and they'll also help other rats by freeing them from traps if anybody has a trap in their house. So you watch out, they can be freed from those traps. You gotta make sure. Then we have, the otter, sea otters in particular here. I didn't realize they apparently hold hands at night so that they don't drift apart. Otherwise, if you fall asleep and you wouldn't find them in the next morning. I mean, we used to have a book, Josh the Otter, and they had to find him, and it was a big sad story, but anyways, Josh is still okay with it. They've also used rocks, don't they, as tools to open up clams and stuff, shells. Now, a giraffe is another one that I think is on one of those videos. Because imagine how hard would it be. It's hard enough for my heart to pump into my brain. Imagine pumping up into a giraffe's brain, and then when a giraffe goes down for water, can I imagine the head rush that you would think as it brings its head up? Like, how does the giraffe, like, sees it, it's down here drinking, and now, I see a bunch of lions. It gets up, and it gets dizzy and falls over? That wouldn't work very good. So God's created it with an amazing valves system so that it can get the, as it bends, it, you know, it adjusts. So it's incredible. Anyways, I got segued on the giraffe. It was kind of interesting. Guinea pigs. So, guinea pigs can communicate in 10 different sounds. That's pretty neat. I won't use the, one of the, including the loud weak. Weak. They use when they're excited or hungry. For those who have had a guinea pig. Dogs have 300 million scent receptors, and I can confirm that my dog has scent receptors for chocolate more recently. 300 million scent receptors, and we only have 6 million. So that's a big fold increase. So they can smell very, very, very well compared to us. Dolphins. So a dolphin can call each other by name. They each have a unique whistle that others can recognize in their pack or pod. Pack of dolphins. I'm sure I'll be told later what that is. Dolphins, group of dolphins, you know, big bunch. They can talk to each other by name. Puffins. Puffins are pretty cute. They can carry multiple fish at once because they have, like, on their tongue, they have these little barbs that point backwards, and so they don't sort of slide out that way. Like when I have the fish, they kind of pop out, but the puffins can hold on to them, and they sort of stick like a barb. So that's so they can have multiple fish on their tongues. Cougars. So cougars can leap up to 18 meters forward. 18 meters. That would be like me to the doorway there, going up, something like that. Crazy. That's a long jump. And they can jump 5.5 meters straight up. So they're one of the most powerful jumpers on the earth. So again, just pulling out some facts from some of these critters are interesting. So here, it's going to give you a little bit of an overlay here. If my mouse is complete, I guess I turned it off. So here we go. I'm going to put this up at the end in case you forget whose favorite was whose. But that was a survey taken of these 12 and unders about what their favorite critter was. So maybe, you know, you have something in common now with some of these young people. So I want to just, as we bring this to a close, I wanted to just recognize that Jesus compares our lives and the things that we worry about with his creation. Let's read from Matthew chapter 6 for a second. For this reason I say to you, don't be worried about your life as to what you'll eat or what you'll drink, nor for your body as to what you'll put on. Look at the birds of the sky. They don't sow or reap, nor gather crops into their barn, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. And so we imagine that we sometimes worry about the things that we have and the things that we don't have, but we realize that God's feeding the animals, and he's also provided us with what we need as well in our lives. Similarly, we have, it carries on here, it says, and why are you worried about the clothing? Notice how the lilies of the field grow. And so it's interesting that the Lord Jesus brings examples of God's creation into some of these stories. How they do not labor, nor do they spin thread for cloth, yet I say to you that not even Solomon in all his glory clothed himself like one of these. But God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace. Will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? And so again, we see these examples where God says we shouldn't worry about our inner lives because God has created us and he's given us everything that we need, and so we want to make sure that we put our trust in him. And so what I hope we've had a little bit of an opportunity to think about tonight is that when we see God's creation, when we see something like a picture of the planet Earth, at some level we start to see God and start to give God glory for and thanks for his amazing creation. The amazing love that he has for us, that he's given us all of this diversity and all this amazing proof of his creative powers and his strength and his might and his long-suffering patience for us. And he wants us to see him in this creation, and so we get to appreciate his character. It teaches us about who he is and his love for us and his power and his knowledge. All of these things are all together in what we see in his creation. And so we have a passage in Psalms. O Lord, how manifold are your works. In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. And lastly, you are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things.